All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. Well, I don't guess I'm on no agenda, but they got Liberty Express up and going. Ain't that funny to have both streams, well, two out of three streams, go wrong at the same time? Well, those of you who were logged in from scotthorton.org/listen, you got to hear fear. But everybody else didn't. All right, well, anyway, so this is the show. Later on, I don't really care who's listening, because later on I'm going to podcast out the interviews to the masses. So, whatever. As long as I record some stuff, I guess it'll be okay. Anyway, Gareth Porter's going to be on the show. And also, there's a guy named Matthew Akins, who writes for Rolling Stone, and I interviewed him this morning and recorded it, and I'm going to play that for you. And so that'll be coming up here 25 minutes or so. Good interview about war crimes in Afghanistan. I admit, not the best audio quality, but, you know, good interview anyway. And anyway, so there's that. Also, I'm going to complain about things. So there will be complaints and interviews on the show today. All right. So the first thing is, in case you hadn't heard, the news, the Democrats, that is the White House, and the rest of the United Nations Security Council, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal with Iran late Saturday night. Glory day, hallelujah. Now, I'm of two minds about this. Count them. One, two. The first one is, oh man, thank God, finally. It ain't quite Nixon goes to China and shakes hands with Mao, but hands, plural, with Mao, which was important. But it's a big deal. And it's not a final deal. It's only an interim deal, but it's a big deal. This is the most negotiating these guys have done with each other in a long time. And this is the beginning of the end of the Iranian-American, the American-Iranian Cold War. Could be. It could also fall apart. And, you know, I don't know. I try not to believe in stuff or have faith in anything or anything like that. Even good intentions are no guarantee. In fact, they're not even a strong indication whether something is going to work out well or not. So, if anything, might indicate to the negative. But I guess, you know, it was hard enough to get. And it was over the objections of the evil. And it's a pretty significant thing. And we'll talk about the details with Gareth here in a little while, and we'll get his take on it all. But I'm here to tell you that the Iranians gave up a lot, a lot. And the Americans, not so much. They're rolling back some sanctions a bit. But the Iranians are really scaling back their nuclear program to an extraordinary degree. And I can only assume that their instructions were to get the thing signed at almost all costs. They don't want to completely give up the ability to enrich uranium. Seems to me like they're willing to give up the word right, that we recognize their right. They seem to be willing to settle for, we'll allow them to keep enriching uranium, as long as we don't make fun of them for the change in phraseology, I guess. But anyway, the whole thing is a giant ridiculous to-do about nothing. Anyway, it's amazing to me that the Iranians would go so far just to allay a bunch of fake concerns. just for the PR, just to try to get the Americans and the Israeli hawks to shut up for a minute with all of their constant threats of bombing, and to give them some sanctions relief, you know, so they can import medicine for their dying. Food for their starving. All they ever had was an electricity program and a little bit of a national interest in maintaining their right to be able to run it and not get pushed around by the bullies of the planet Earth. But they never were making nukes. They know they couldn't make a single one before America and Israel bombed the hell out of them with nukes. They know that they don't have the ability to secretly construct a nuke, secretly construct a parallel nuclear weapons project and get it done before getting blown to kingdom come themselves. A nuclear weapon would not be an asset for the Iranians. And they hadn't thought so for a long, long time. The only time when they were considering it was back before America got rid of Saddam Hussein for them. And they thought the Americans might send Saddam back in here. And we might need an atom bomb to keep him out. Let's think about it. Nah. And then especially once they were successful in hiring Ahmed Chalabi to promise the neocons that if American boys died in an Iraq war, it would be good for Israel. And once that was successful, and they got rid of Saddam Hussein, that was their even last consideration of attempting to construct and obtain nuclear weapons. The whole thing is a farce. The whole thing is just Israel's fears through a megaphone. And, you want to talk about the power of the Israel lobby in America. How about the degree to which the American government pretends this is an actual concern, Iranian nuclear weapons, when they all know it's the whole thing is ridiculous and always has been. But more to the point, more interesting really, is the degree to which the Iranians are willing to bend over backwards to satisfy almost all of the demands. And, I don't know. I don't want to give ammo to those who say the sanctions are working, because I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think the people of Iran certainly want the sanctions lifted, and they want a normalization of the relationship with the Americans. Of course, before Ahmadinejad, the Iranians, the same supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, they were willing to make a deal like this back 10 years ago. And even during Ahmadinejad, they were prepared to do the fuel swap deal that would, you know, basically assure that they would not have a stockpile of 20% enriched uranium 235 that they could ever, by fantasy, quickly snap their fingers or flip a light switch and turn into weapons grade 94% or more pure stuff. So they would basically export their 20% uranium. And then there were variations on the deal, but they would have the uranium turned into fuel rods in France or in Turkey, and then, or perhaps in Russia, and then they would be shipped back. And, you know, really the deal failed in 2009 because the Obama team didn't really pursue it. They only pretended to. And then the Israelis sabotaged it by hiring Jandallah bin Ladenite terrorists to attack and kill a bunch of Iranian generals in October 2009, and as the deal was falling apart, and in fact at that point it was Ahmadinejad that wanted to do the deal more than the Supreme Leader, they say, but then Obama came out and made sure he had his own self-imposed deadline. They must accede to all of our demands within 1 year or else more sanctions, which, you know, offer they can't possibly accept. That was the whole point. And then he came out and put the icing on the cake with the pretended revelation of the facility under construction at Fordo, the COM facility, or that's the other way around, at COM, the Fordo facility, I guess they call it, which the Iranians had declared to the IAEA 4 days before. And then Obama, Cameron, and Sarkozy gave a big press conference, said, oh, we're busting them with their secret enrichment facility. And then some people said, yeah, but didn't they declare that 4 days ago? And then the Americans told David Sanger to write in the newspaper that, yeah, but we believe that they only admitted it, declared it, 4 days before, because they knew that we were about to bust them. Oh, yeah? Well, how so? They never said. The implication, I guess, being that the Iranians had secret agent spies on Obama's speechwriting staff. Is that it? Does anybody believe that? Or that the diplomats who had been working on trying to get the deal done had said, we know all about your comp facility, and if this fails, we're going to tell everybody on you? Because they never made that argument. All they said is, anonymous sources claim to David Sanger, the liar, that we believe because we feel like believing it. That they only declared what they declared because they knew we were about to bust them. So we pretended it was a bust anyway, 4 days later. What a lie. What a stupid lie. Damn Democrats. But anyway, even under Ahmadinejad, they were willing to negotiate away anything basically that makes tiny little Benjamin Netanyahu cry in his tiny little sissy pants. Oh, does the 20% uranium make you cry in your tiny sissy pants? Mr. Netanyahu, I'll tell you what, we'll swap out the 20% uranium. That's still more than 70% below what it needs to be weapons-grade uranium. But anyway, we'll swap it out. They were willing to do that even under Ahmadinejad. So, but anyway, I guess it's possible that to some degree, maybe there's a partial concession that can be made that the sanctions have been so harsh as Obama adopts Israeli policy of collective punishment of the innocent there, depriving grandmothers and dying children of the medicines that they need to survive in order to create political pressure in the country to see something happen here. But I think really the people of Iran are just, they're looking for an end to this Cold War. If they're not, celebrating as the right wing's trying to spin it that, oh yeah, we get to keep our weapons program and get the sanctions lifted. They're celebrating that the sanctions are going to be lifted at all. They know it's not a weapons program. They know the whole thing is a giant, ridiculous negotiation over nothing, over a bunch of safeguarded facilities. Oh, wow, so now you're going to extra safeguard the facilities you're already safeguarding, huh? Neat. Can I please buy some chemotherapy for my dying little brother? Now, they say. So, they're happy to see a normalization of relations with the beginning of one, the possibility of one, and I'm seeing that same possibility. Now, Garrett Porter's going to come and rain all over my happy parade here, which is all right. That's his job. But on the positive side, this is the most progress that's been made along these lines in a long, long time. And I just mean, really, to state it very plainly, in case you're not catching my drift, to just undermine the lie that there's a nuclear weapons, you know, emotion in Iran that needs protecting from. There's nobody even trying to make nukes there. There's nobody in the government saying, we ought to make nukes. Their worst hardliners are not saying, what we ought to do is withdraw from the treaty and start making nukes. The whole thing is a big fake scam. But my thing is, anything to shut up the people pushing the big fake scam, anything that can work to help shut them up, like extra super double verification of the safeguardedness and the non-diversion of all of Iran's nuclear material, then I hope that can only be good news. I mean, boo-hoo, they support Hezbollah. You care about that? It's not quite as scary as an atom bomb, is it?
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking and war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. All right, so the economics minister of Israel put a thing up on his Facebook page saying, oh yeah, boo-hoo, one day there will be a suitcase nuke will go off in Madrid or New York or D.C. or something. And it'll be all your fault for not listening to me. Well, this guy, Naftali Bennett, he's a fascist. And yeah, you can go read all about him. He's one of these greater Israel guys, unapologetic land rustlers. And, jeez. Think there would have been a time where he would have been read out of polite Israeli society, but not anymore. Oh, there ain't nothing beyond the pale for Israel now. Nothing. So anyway, it was strange the way the thing was worded, because he didn't really say, you know, the Iranians are probably going to nuke you. It was ambiguous enough that it could be interpreted as a threat. Now, I don't really think he meant to leave it that way. I don't know. It sure does kind of read that way. But you should know that either one... a couple things. Sorry, I don't talk good. Me, talk rat. First thing is, there's no such thing as a suitcase nuke. Except on TV where they make up stuff that ain't right because it makes for good TV. But even a battlefield artillery piece... A-bomb is a pretty big thing, and it's got this whole separate thingamajig that comes with it. It's a big two-part deal with a command module, all this crap. You can fit it in the back of a Lincoln Town Car, but you can't walk around carrying a nuclear bomb in a briefcase. There's no such thing. Anyway, so that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, the Iranians aren't making nuclear bombs. This is such nonsense. And, you know, it seems to me, and I don't know why I always want to give the Israelis advice. I kind of don't care. But they're just so stupid, I kind of got to criticize them in a constructive way. Like, hey, your lies are so stupid, you're just making us all hate you. Shut up. Why don't you go and hire a new PR firm and try out some lies that it might impress an actual focus group full of nitwits? Because at this point, we've heard your same BS wolf cries 10 million times. Guess what, everybody? If Iran had been making nukes this whole time, don't you think they might have had some by now? Yeah, that's right. The Israelis are liars. And all they do all day is wake up in the morning and tell lies. You know, because they want you to fight your war, their wars for them. And in fact, there's this great article today at the 972 blog, which they're Israeli peaceniks. And this is about how the actual, you know, professional state, national security state of Israel, they're for the peace deal, the nuclear deal with Iran.
Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't represent what they think. Benjamin Netanyahu is a kook and a liar. But these are actual generals and spies and stuff, and they at least have to justify credibility to each other, you know? So they don't get to piss and moan and cry and scream and make up ridiculous things like Netanyahu all day. They got to talk to each other. And they keep saying they like the thing. Although I thought it was interesting how he can just throw in here, as though everybody knows that, which I don't know if they do or not. They should. But he just kind of throws in as a matter of course, as if everyone understands, that, well, you know, these generals, they are not in principle against bombing Iran at all. Don't think that. Well, here's what he says. The Israeli brass are certainly not peaceniks. They're not sanguine at all about the prospects of a nuclear-armed Iran. They're not opposed in principle to bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. In fact, like with most Israelis, their preferred solution is for the U.S. to bomb them. Well, America to Israel, go to hell. Fight your own wars. Get your own stupid kids killed and leave ours alone. As though America's just a farm where Israel grows their cannon fodder. Screw you and your crappy fascist society. Make the South Africans look enlightened in their apartheid era. All you do is lie all day. And all you do is try to get other people's kids killed for whatever ridiculous whim, whatever ridiculous lie you got to carry out, you got to practice in front of people. Hey, I know. Let's pretend that there's a nuclear weapons threat from Iran. And let's pretend it's so bad that we actually get American parents' kids killed. Because screw them. Right? Well, screw you. I'd like to put all of Israel in a box and close it and shake the shit out of it. And then yell really loud in one end. Yeah, how do you like it? Hi, we're the Israelis. All we do is get up in the morning and tell lies so that you can get your son killed on our lying behalf over threats that aren't real. Because we suck. We're worse even than you Americans, who are the most violent people in the world. How bad is that? I mean, it's a proportional thing. I think if you went by population per capita, Israel's more violent, more cruel, more dishonest than Americans on their worst day. And I mean the Cheney years or the Roosevelt ones. Either Roosevelt. I am so sick of Israelis talking about, I prefer like at 972 Mag where they go ahead and say it out loud and don't not under their breath. But I'm just so sick of knowing that the Israelis would just as soon 300 million American boys die in their wars. They don't care. Get all the Americans killed they can. From the Tigris to the, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Euphrates River, right? Greater Israel, Uber Alles, down to the last Iowan, down to the last Louisianan, how do you say those? Down to the last Texan. Oh, a suitcase nuke might go off in your city. Yeah, one might go off in yours. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society.
empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Here's that interview with Matthew Akins from earlier this morning. Oh, no.
Introducing Matthew Akins, reporter for Rolling Stone magazine, on the phone from Kabul. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Matthew?
Good, thanks.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show here, and a great piece of work that you've done here. The article is The A-Team Killings in Rolling Stone, the November 6th issue. About the Rangers and accusations of at least participation in war crimes. And I want to obviously spend the bulk of the interview talking about that, but I was hoping we could get a couple of things out of the way first. And in fact, just starting with your take on the meeting with the Jirga and the dispute over the immunity and all of that. I saw a report this morning saying that Karzai may put off signing the paperwork and let the next president take the responsibility. What do you know about that?
Well, I don't think that Karzai is going to be able to delay it that long. I think there's just going to be too much pressure on him by the U.S. and NATO to sign an agreement before the end of the year that will give them some ability to plan for, you know, what they're going to do with their military deployment over the next year. So more of a brinksmanship tactic, which Karzai excels at. You know, he's playing a weak hand. He's kind of stuck between the demands of the United States, which he thinks is an unreasonable ally, and the growing resentment of the Afghan people about, you know, the foreign military presence in the country. So he's trying to play that hand as best he can by sort of flirting with the edge, so to speak, mm-hmm. and hoping the U.S. will blink first in terms of bowing some of his demands.
And now, is it your estimation that the current government could stand without American support into next year and on into 20-whatever?
I think that if you suddenly withdrew international support, we're not just talking military support. I mean, if the troops go, then a lot of these governments aren't going to be pumping billions of dollars in foreign aid and development assistance into the country. So if you have a sudden withdrawal of both troops and money, I think that the shock of that would be enough to, yeah, possibly set off a full-scale collapse of the government, or if not that, then certainly a rapid curtailment of its influences in the province. Mm.
Well, do you think there's a safe pace that withdrawal could be done, complete withdrawal could be accomplished on, or by, or with?
You know, it's a difficult question to answer because there's a number of, you know, kind of complex factors in terms of, you know, the state of the insurgency. You know, the varying hypotheses about whether it feeds off the foreign military or whether it would be just as strong if we left. Regional issues, relationships with Iran and Pakistan and Central Asia, And then also questions about, you know, whether there'd be enough in terms of the indigenous economy to keep the government going. But certainly you would have a, it would be a very drastic scenario for the Afghan government. They would have to find some sort of arrangement with, you know, the various groups that are battling now in order to survive.
But now you talked about, you know, popular opinion. Are they willing to go ahead and maybe even sacrifice worse chaos to get the internationals out for now and maybe try to put things together themselves? And then I guess part of that same question would be, how representative is the Loya Jirga that is, you know, ratifying this document for the president?
Well, the answer is not particularly representative. Loya Jirga was handpicked by Karzai, you know, people to give a relatively pliant group in Kabul. Neither is the Afghan government, for that matter. I mean, we can't really call it a representative institution, given how drastically flawed the elections have been. In fact, I would say that the government in Kabul is much more representative of its own interests, which are that of a classic rentier state. And the rents in this case are, you know, the billions that are coming from the international community. So almost all these people in Kabul who form the government are in their bread buttered by the international money, one way or another. So their interests don't really lie in a withdrawal, and you can't really say that they're going to reflect the will of people in that case.
And then, but so, and I know this is asking you to, I guess, speculate a lot, but could you estimate whether you think that a majority of the Afghan population, if they can even be grouped together that way, I mean, that may be kind of foolish, but do you think a majority of them would just as soon try to work this out without our help, even if it's, you know, rough for the in the short term as the current power bubble pops, so to speak?
Well, I don't think that, I think it's a very difficult question to ask. You know, I would say on one hand, probably the average Afghan, or certainly, you know, many Afghans, especially in the rural areas, don't think that foreign military forces are playing a helpful role in this country. A lot of them maybe even more, you know, vigorously or violently opposed. But at the same time, if you take one of the poorest countries on Earth, right, and you ask the people of that country, do you want the international community to stop spending billions of dollars in your country in development aid, then they're probably not going to say they want that either. I mean, they don't want the world to turn their back on them. They know they need help from the international community, but question is whether, you know, the price has been too high or unnecessarily high.
All right, now, the story that you've reported on here in the A-Team killings, I'm certain, well, I can only guess, I should say, has a lot to do with the conversation right now, at least among the population, about whether, you know, this continued immunity should be passed on for soldiers staying after 2014. But before we get right into the story, I was hoping that you could describe for us a little bit about how you did this journalism, because I think it's important that people understand, for example, the photo lineups and stuff that you did, and the time that you took in putting this story together before you published it.
Sure. Well, what essentially happened was that, you know, about a year ago, a team of U.S. Special Forces, Green Berets, called an A-Team, moved into Nark District in Wardak Province, which is a remote area west of Kabul. And, you know, they were there for only a few months before these allegations of murder, torture, enforced disappearance started surfacing among the local people. They complained, they made demonstrations. The Afghan government ordered an inquiry. U.S. military denied, you know, they had any role in these incidents, these allegations. 10 men went missing. Probably there was nothing about Karzai forced the team to leave the base. And after they left us, and these bodies started turning up, buried close to the perimeter of the U.S. Special Forces base, bodies that the local villagers said belonged to these 10 men. So that's where I found the incident. And because the U.S. military had still categorically denied everything, in terms of its own involvement, even after bodies started coming out of the ground and no one really knew who this unit was, the whole incident was kind of shrouded in mystery and never really saw the proper light of day, or got it much pickup in the Western press. So I spent about 5 months this summer, and then I live in Kabul, I'm based in Kabul. I spent about 5 months this summer in Afghanistan, traveling to that area, just kind of difficult to do because it was a very heavy Taliban presence. I interviewed dozens of victims, family members, witnesses, officials, you know, both Afghan and Western. And eventually ascertained the identity of the team and basically, you know, came to the conclusion that there was a substantial body of evidence to show that these men had been taken into custody, often in broad daylight in front of, you know, the whole village. I was an American Special Forces team, and their bodies had turned up buried outside the wire. So clearly, the onus is on the U.S. to explain how he's been ended up dead, buried outside their base. The U.N. and the Red Cross had also done confidential investigations, I learned, but had found the same conclusions that corroborated the allegations. And I eventually visited one of the translators for this unit, who'd been arrested and put in prison, sort of being made the fall guy by the Afghan government. The team, of course, had already left and returned to the United States. And I was able to get photos of these individuals from Facebook. And as you mentioned, I mixed them up into sort of a grid with random images of other Special Forces soldiers that I saw on the internet during a sort of photo array like they use in police investigations. And that just goes back to WARDAC and, you know, had villagers basically pick people out of the lineup without any prompting. And, well, you know, if you read the article, you'll see we laid out a very comprehensive dossier of evidence that suggests that the Special Forces team was complicit in some of the most egregious war crimes committed by U.S. forces since 2001.
All right, now, your phone just got a little bit screwy on us, so I guess I'll ask you to, I don't know, maybe try to hold it different or something. I don't know if there's a change that you think you might have made that made it sound a little screwy, but pretty much we can hear you all right. I think we can continue. Yeah, so it is a very well put together article here, and of course, as is especially necessary with subject matter like this. And now, I guess before we get too much further into the story, can we talk about, of the evidence and all of that, what actually happened there? But can you give us an update, as like you do in your recent blog entry here, about the state of the I guess it's two separate investigations, one American one and one by the Afghan government as well, right?
Right. Well, in July, the Army opened up, you know, after months of denial, the Army opened up a criminal investigation into the incident, and they told me that this was in response to new information that was provided to them by the Red Cross. So that investigation is ongoing. During my 5 months of investigation, none of the dozens of people that I spoke to, you know, who were key and central witnesses in this case, had ever been contacted by U.S. military investigators. So I suppose the most charitable interpretation of that is that they haven't been given the resources to do their jobs properly. But it was unclear to me how this investigation could have achieved anything without talking to the central witnesses in the case. On the Afghan side, they've all also been kind of half-hearted in their approach because, for one thing, the Afghan security forces don't really have a very high capacity to undertake rigorous criminal investigations, especially when it involves, you know, members of the U.S. military. And they haven't received any cooperation from the U.S. In fact, they said that they had an internal report that was reported on by Reuters. They had closed their investigation because of lack of cooperation from the United States military. So it remains to be seen whether there's going to be any accounting for these incidents, whether there's going to be, you know, proper accountability, criminal accountability. But there is, because of the article, there have been some calls from Human Rights Watch, from the UN, from other organizations saying that, you know, it's key that the U.S. military ensure that there's a proper accounting for
Well, that's good. Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear that the article has had some effect in that sense. But also, I thought it was notable the way that you say it in your blog entry here, "Will justice be served in the 18 killings?" The follow-up blog entry at RollingStone.com, where you talk about, you know, listen, this must mean that they're not getting the resources, as you just mentioned, that they're not getting the resources to actually do the investigation. But you're a Rolling Stone reporter, and you went out there and talked with the families, and you were able to get this done. And so since they're the army and everything, I think they're right out of excuses, right? You didn't have a bunch of force protection out there on the road. They got helicopters and A-10s and everything else. They can go investigate whatever they want, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the military can't be as freewheeling as a reporter can. I disguised myself as an Afghan and drove in a civilian car through some pretty dodgy terrain that way. But certainly if they wanted to properly resource the investigation, then they could fly helicopters out to the area.
The problem would be red tape, not the actual situation on the ground.
Well, like I said, the most charitable interpretation for what seems to be a complete lack of progress on the ground by the investigation is that they haven't been getting proper resources. You know, there's other explanations. The Army, you know, we've wondered since early on in this investigation how it was possible for at least someone, at least one level in the chain of command above this unit not to have known to some degree what was going on. Not to have been complicit in what amounted to a cover-up of these incidents. You know, the U.S. Army was informed as early as November by, they acknowledged this to me, by Afghans who complained about seeing a translator execute a man named Gul Rahim. Incident, I documented the story. Mm-hmm. A translator execute a man named Gul Rahim in the field in front of U.S. military forces.
So that was when they first got there, right? They were there from November 2012 to spring of this year, April of this year, correct?
That's when the incident began. As I explained the piece, they arrived probably a couple months earlier.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Around that time period, at the end of October, their team sergeant was shot and grievously wounded. And, you know, it's quite possible, quite likely, I think, that losing their team sergeant, sort of the father of the team, may have been the trigger for this kind of abuses, and certainly the timing would line up. But in any case, the U.S. military was notified right at the beginning, you know, when some of the first men were missing, and yet it took another, you know, 15 deaths for there to be that public outcry to force the team out. To me, it stretches the limits of credulity to think that at least someone above these guys didn't understand that something, that the crimes that they committed. And it took the Red Cross, you know, informing them of it in July to open a criminal investigation. So the question really is, how could there not have been at least some official complicity into what amounts to an attempted cover-up? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a lot of bodies. Well, and it's not like they did a very good job. I mean, the soldiers themselves of covering up in the first place, just putting the bodies right outside the wire, basically, right?
It's not clear who was putting the bodies outside the wire. There's some possibility, speculation, that it could have actually been the translator who was doing the actual, you know, burial, possibly killing as well of these prisoners. But, you know, again, as I write in the piece, it seems impossible that he could have done it without their knowledge. You know, it's a small base, and can't just start digging outside the wire without these special forces guys noticing right. You're out there digging, right? And there's also other indications, you know, that they knew that this guy, Zikri Kandari, had killed prisoners before in previous deployment. So, in any case, you know, but that being said, I think that these teams operate with such impunity, and they operate independently, usually in more remote locations, that Well, I you can't say that necessarily they've been burying bodies before, but I think that a lot of these special forces teams certainly have participated in abusive interrogations, certainly have, you know, been so aggressive in their actions that they've killed civilians unnecessarily. And so I think that they don't really worry too much about oversight either.
Yeah. Well, now, there is footage of this. If people want to see it, it's at Rolling Stone, and it's pretty disturbing, and it's the, I believe it's the Kandahari, they call him, the translator who's at least taking all the blame, if not the actual responsibility for this, is the one actually doing the whipping in the video, but then there are American Special Forces revealed standing in the background, correct?
Actually, that's a separate video. That has nothing to do with this incident, as far as we know.
Oh, really?
It's a bit of a strange coincidence, but it was just something that it came across the course of my research. So it appears to be a mix of Afghan Army soldiers and translators definitely whipping an Afghan detainee as what almost certainly are and certainly appear to be American Special Forces soldiers look on. I think the video is fairly recent, but we don't have any identities of the individuals in the video. So that's actually a separate issue, and I think it kind of goes to how this is part of a larger pattern of the abuse of prisoners by Americans and by their Afghan allies. That has, you know, been well documented since 2001, continued for the last 10 years, and that we're still seeing happening today. And it's related to the climate of impunity and lack of accountability that exists within the U.S. military for these kinds of abuses. People aren't investigated for these sorts of things, and even when they are, they receive little to no punishment.
Well, now, the torture by the Afghan government of prisoners has been bad enough over the last few years, and I guess especially in the Obama years, right, where the American military has officially and in the media, you know, given orders that, or I forget which it is now. I'm sorry, I'm messing this up. But was it the military, the CIA, or somebody's banned from turning their prisoners over to the Afghans because they'll get tortured? So just put everybody in American-run jails instead or for a time or something because they themselves are acknowledging that the problem is so out of hand that they don't want to be complicit in it.
Yeah, well, what it is that, you know, in 2011, late 2011, the UN published a report that documented systematic abuse in Afghan detention facilities, the use of torture and for interrogation and extracting forced confessions, and in both, you know, Afghan police and intelligence custody. So even though, you know, everyone knew this was happening for years, I've written about it, this is really serious official confirmation. And the U.S. and especially the European allies, who actually have domestic legal obligations not to transfer individuals into torture, unlike the U.S., they were concerned enough about it to halt transfers to Afghan prisons, detainees, where there were documented cases of serious abuse, which is quite a number of facilities, particularly in the south and southeast of the country where the conflict is strongest. So that remains an ongoing issue. IFAS still hasn't, the International Security Assistance Force, the U.S. and NATO mission in Afghanistan, I still haven't resumed transfers to certain facilities where some of the worst practices are continuing to be documented. And in fact, you know, as I write in this story, as I report in the story, you know, last summer the ISAF and the CIA actually had a falling out over this issue because the CIA, you know, in its paramilitary operations in Afghanistan, continued to work with sites that were associated with torture. And ISAF didn't feel like it could, so joint military cooperation in the field temporarily broke down in summer 2012 over this issue.
Yeah, well, now, can you talk about Bagram Prison? Do you know much about what's going on there and the degree to which Appendix M is used as the floor or the ceiling for how interrogations are carried out by the military there? Because that's, I guess, that's not special forces guys, off books guys. These are the rank and file running that thing.
Right? Well, what's happened is that the facility in Bagram, which is now being called a Parwan detention facility, it has been transferred to Afghan control. So the Afghans actually house the prisoners of Bagram.
Oh, how long ago was that?
Technically speaking. That's been ongoing. It's happened over this past year. Basically started, I think, in spring, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But in any case, it's more of a... in practice, the U.S. retains substantial control over the prisons. The U.S. has guards inside. There are still a number of prisoners who are still in... who still haven't been transferred, like, through the system into Afghan control. And then there's additional facilities that aren't really... that are temporary and aren't really acknowledged as such, you know, that are used by the Joint Special Operations Command of the CIA. Mm-hmm. And there's also, of course, the international prisoners, you know, individuals from third countries who are usually associated with Al-Qaeda who are still being held at Bagram, sort of the other Guantanamo. So it's a pretty complex situation, to be honest. But
yeah,
actually, you know, in fairness, you have to say that the detention facility at Bagram is probably the best run and cleanest, most hygienic prison in the country compared to an Afghan detention facility. It's not such a bad place to be.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, and I'm sorry because I should have really made sure to get this covered in the middle of the interview somewhere instead of, you know, tacking it on at the end here. But I was hoping that you could tell at least if two or three of these stories of who these individuals were, because, you know, when they're aliens from some faraway place and just nameless corpses in the ground that, I mean, we don't even see the corpses. We just read, you know, black text on a white page. Doesn't quite bring it home, but you tell the story of who these people were and how innocent we know they were. These just regular folks who got caught up in, you know, wrong place, wrong time, dealing with these Army Rangers and their translator.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know that they're all innocent, but the point is that even if they were guilty, they can't take a prisoner out and shoot him in the back of the head.
No, I agree with that, but, you know, I just mean it's kind of easier for the average person to assume that, well, they must have been fighters, and whatever happened to them, I don't care that much kind of thing. It's easier that way. But if you know that it's just some guy and his cousin picking berries or whatever, it makes it different.
Well, one thing you have to understand about a place like Nerf is that people there are living between a rock and a hard place. On one side, they have... the Taliban or other insurgent groups that live in their villages, that have deep roots in the community, who own the night. And when they come to you and ask you to give them some food and let them stay in your place for the night, and they ask them to, you know, let them use your backyard to store their weapons or for your son to come help them carry some ammunition over the mountain, you know, no is not... not an answer. It's tougher. You can't refuse. If you do, you'll end up dead. And then on the other hand, you have the American military pressing down on you, where the visit from those Taliban fighters can mean that the next day a drone's going to come and drop a missile on your house, or the special forces are going to come and kick down your door and haul you away, thinking that you're a member of the Taliban. So that's the kind of pressure that they're living under. But a lot of these people were just simple, illiterate villagers, farmers. Some were sons of civil servants working in the government. They all had, you know, lots of family members who cared about them. And in this kind of place, you live with your extended family and you have to stick together to survive. It's a really tough place to make ends meet. So, yeah, I spoke to a lot of the families and sat with them and, you know, sort of reopened their grief and their wounds, and listen to them talk about their loved ones who they've seen taken away by the Americans, and then 3-4 months down the road, they're digging their desiccated corpses out of a pit. So these are real human beings with lives and names and kids and parents, and they had hopes and dreams, and now they're dead.
Yeah. Well, that's what's the bottom line of this whole thing. It makes it very real and not some academic exercise about how our nation-building project is going over there. But nope, that's real suffering, the dead and all the people who love them, too. And so, anyway, thank you for helping tell this story, Matthew. Great work.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Everybody, that's Matthew Akins, writing for Rolling Stone magazine. He's out of Kabul, Afghanistan. The piece is The A-Team Killings. It's in the November issue, November 2013. And here's the follow-up at the blog is, will justice be served in the A-Team Killings?
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm me. This is the show. ScottHorton.org is the website. You can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. I spend way too much time trolling around on Facebook, so if you're like that too, well, then click the button there. Twitter too, man. I gotta get over that. All right, anyway. Glad to have y'all here, and glad to introduce our next guest on the show today. It's Gareth Porter the Great, independent historian and journalist. Mostly writes for Interpress Service at ipsnews.net. That's ipsnews.net, Interpress Service. They got a great bunch of writers there, by the way, journalists, I mean to say. And also he writes for truthout.org. He does award-winning work for truthout.org, including on Afghanistan, which I hope to ask about later in the show. But first of all, welcome back. How are you doing, Gareth?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Scott. How are you?
Good, good. Happy to have you back on the show as always. So here's the thing. Before you break my heart, let me tell you how in love I am with this whole theory that now the whole thing with Iran is basically okay. And by that I mean it seems that a fatal blow may have been delivered to the slogan, because that's all it ever was, that Iran is a nuclear weapons threat to Israel and or America and or a fly. So now, instead of having safeguarded facilities where every atom of their uranium is accounted for and verified to not have ever been diverted to any military or other special purpose, now it will be extra super duper verified, and no one will be able to pretend that they think that this has anything to do with a nuclear weapons threat again. They're going to convert their 20% uranium stocks to uses that make it unavailable for future possible use in nuclear weapons. They're going to scale back all of their centrifuges. They're going to not even bother, apparently, turning on the Iraq reactor that could one day produce weapons-grade plutonium, which then could step conceivably be nuclear bomb fuel. None of that's going to happen. And so then the only hard propaganda lines that can be used against Iran after that are just that the Ayatollah is a real jerk and that he funds Hezbollah and Hezbollah is bad and everybody knows Hezbollah is bad and that kind of thing. But the mushroom cloud is a neutralized threat means this is has to mean that there's at least a huge possibility, a huge chance, almost unblowable chance for this to be the beginning of the end of the American-Iranian Cold War and beginning of the normalization of relations between our two countries, and then everything would be great. So now tell me why I'm a damn fool and I should know better than that.
Well, I don't think anything you've said is at all wrong, except for possibly the, not possibly, I think the final conclusion that this brings us somehow closer to normalization of relations. I think that's a big long leap from everything else that you said. But certainly it's true that the negotiation of this deal in Geneva over the weekend is a blow, a serious blow, to the entire media and official narrative that we have been subjected to for the last decade and more, that Iran is a threat to get nuclear weapons, wants to get nuclear weapons, and so forth. And I think you've outlined very briefly the main reasons. That is to say, the agreement includes a raft of provisions that even the White House or the administration is saying to journalists has made it virtually impossible for Iran to find a path to a nuclear weapon. I see that the Washington Post yesterday had a story that quoted unnamed administration senior source saying precisely that. So, in fact, I mean, you're absolutely right that this should really close the door on that whole media narrative, and usher in an entirely new era of U.S. relations. But, and there's a huge but here, the administration is keeping open its options in terms of what happens now. And this is where the story that I'm working on right now, and I think maybe for the first time since you started interviewing me, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you a preview of what this story is going to say, even though it's not finished. It's about 80% finished, I would say, at this point. And what I'm writing about is the fact that in a background briefing for the press, late Saturday night, Washington, D.C. time, early morning Geneva time, the senior officials, unnamed, who gave these briefings, repeatedly referred to the negotiations for the final, solution, the comprehensive solution that is outlined in the text of the deal, as not as to how we're going to achieve technically this objective of showing that Iran is not able to or is not intending to have nuclear weapons, but whether. Now, at first glance that may not seem like a big deal, surprised and alarmed me, I must say, is that five different times during the relatively brief briefing for the press, at least two, I think it was just two senior officials, although it was never made clear how many there were, repeatedly essentially gave the same formulation, saying that it's not a question of whether, not a question of how, but whether we will be able to achieve a comprehensive solution to this in which the Iranians can prove to us that their intentions are peaceful. Now, that's not an accident. That's clearly the result of a policy decision by the Obama administration
team. Well, wait a minute, but that's,
team.
Gareth, that's not just them trying to make the hawks hush. I mean, here's the thing. Obama, when he gave his speech Saturday night, He sounded like George W. Bush in the damn thing, announcing a peace deal, but making it sound almost like he's declaring war or something, because he's just trying to get Chuck Schumer and the worse than that to pipe down a bit while he gets this thing done. But meanwhile, I'm reading a 3,000-word report in Reuters about how they've been secretly working on this thing for months, and they're so damn serious about it, and that's why it went so well, and that this is the top priority. So aren't they just trying to shut up the Republicans?
No, I don't think they're just trying to shut up the Republicans. I mean, obviously it's useful to portray the administration's policy as, not committed to a final solution. I mean, I think that it does have propaganda value for them. I agree with that. But the fact that they are, basically taking the position that, this is not a question of how we're going to do this, but whether we're going to do it, is definitely potentially significant, at least potentially significant, in terms of giving the United States the freedom of action in the end to say, well, we're not satisfied with what the Iranians are proposing, and so we're just going to hold on to the very commanding position that we have in bargaining terms with Iran. And until they're prepared to go all the way to satisfy U.S. demands, which could take the form of essentially saying no enrichment, we're just going to maintain the status quo. And I think that this could reflect, and I think it does reflect, in fact, the administration senior officials, basically their assessment that Iran is in a desperate position and has to get an agreement, and that the United States can therefore call the shots. So you're right that it's useful for propaganda purposes, but the fact that it is useful for propaganda purposes does not, it's not inconsistent, it's not mutually inconsistent with the fact or the real possibility that the administration is going to use this perception of a commanding bargaining leverage advantage over Iran to essentially maintain a longer-term position of dominance over Iran. Bear in mind, and I think this brings us back to one of the fundamental issues that continues to recur every time we discuss U.S. policy toward Iran, that there are really two kinds of interests that come into play in terms of the history of U.S. policy toward Iran. One is the kind of bureaucratic, institutional, parochial interests that I've suggested have been a strong component, a strong reason for the United States to maintain the enmity relationship with Iran for more than, almost three decades now, but particularly over the last couple of decades. But then there's a second reason for the continued hostility toward Iran, which I think has to do with the psychological factor in U.S. policy, the fact that the top level of officials, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor in particular, gain a certain psychological lift from being able to dominate a country like Iran, being able to portray themselves and the United States as being in a dominant position over Iran. I think this opportunity that they now see is one that really represents almost an irresistible temptation, if you will, for the United States to continue the same kind of dominance behavior that it has essentially exhibited for the last three decades with regard to Iran.
Right. Yeah, in other words, we might as well just have Chuck Schumer and Hillary Clinton up there in charge of this thing.
Well, yeah, I think that there is a lot of commonality between, the neocon position and the Obama administration position with regard to the desire to keep U.S. hegemony, if you will, in the Middle East and specifically over Iran. And,
right.
We know that, it used to be that the military option was the key to sort of coercive diplomacy with regard to Iran.
But maybe they could just, you know, actually drop the nuclear weapons threat as their bogus threat and come up with other reasons to still not normalize relations, you know?
Let me finish my point, because what I was going to say is that, you know, the military threat was always regarded as the key to being able to coerce Iran. Now that's no longer a credible threat. I mean, everybody understands that in the Middle East. And I think U.S. officials generally, you know, privately would admit that, yeah, that no longer makes any sense. We can't really use that effectively. The Iranians don't believe it, nor do the Israelis. And so we've now discovered a new equivalent of the military threat, which is the fact that we have this stranglehold over the Iranian economy. And so that has a kind of value that transcends the specific problem of the Iranian nuclear threat. And I just think they're going to hold on to that as long as they can.
Yeah.
You know, now, if the Iranians are ready to capitulate completely in a symbolic way, then I think they would be happy to accept that. But I think that they want to hold on to it short of that kind of capitulation.
Well, okay, so for example, in the interim deal on the right to enrich, they got these weasel words that amount to, we'll allow you to enrich, just don't call it a right, something like that. That
yeah,
could
I mean,
persist,
I think the point,
right?
It bears notice here that in the days following the failed round of negotiations, U.S. officials from Kerry on down made a very big deal out of the fact that, no, we're not going to acknowledge the right to enrich. The Iranians clearly were very concerned about that, and this was obviously the primary issue on which things were hung up for the last 24 hours and more in Geneva. And in the final text, there is language that certainly comes closer to the Iranian position than it does to the American position, that there's nothing in there that acknowledges anything like a right to enrich. And it's very complicated language. I'm not even going to try to read it, but I can tell you that that it does come closer to the Iranian position than to the American position. But the Americans clearly were very eager to avoid that, if at all possible. And by the way, it's very significant that no official text has been issued by the U.S. government. I've been asking today. I went to the State Department and to the White House. Neither of them had any text. I mean, they admitted that no text had been issued. Couldn't explain why. And for me, I mean, the explanation is that they would rather be able to, you know, use background briefings and, you know, speeches to tell the American people what the agreement says rather than have the American people read it.
Yeah. Well, so The Guardian, they got their version from the Iranians, in other words. That's all we have.
Well, exactly. That's what we have so far. And I don't think the U.S. government has any intention to issue an official text.
Right, because then they might have to, when they're talking with just the little State Department pool reporters, they might have to go down the list and really discuss what's in there in a way that right now
I think they'd rather, you know, be able to simply tell the reporters, here's what it says,
right.
Tell the American people, here's what it says, and,
okay,
and,
so,
and avoid the reality.
Now, the empire wants to be the empire, and they don't want to give an inch on anything, and that goes to every last man in the damn thing implementing it, too, and all of that. But when you say that means that the status quo is more likely to prevail, are you talking the old status quo or the new one? Because it seems like if they don't have a deal in 6 months and the Americans try to drag this out, then the Iranians are going to say they're at least going to go back to where they were, you know, last Thursday, right? So that's going to be a real problem.
You're absolutely right. And that's where the rubber is going to hit the road. And, you know, they will test whether they have the kind of commanding bargaining leverage that it seems from the hints, you know, I would say even more than hints, but certainly indications from this background briefing that the administration calculates that they're in a very strong bargaining position. But I think they definitely want to try that out. They want to test, you know, whether they can coerce the Iranians, basically, to either accept a deal that the Iranians would have found unacceptable unless they're desperate, or, you know, essentially take a chance that that they can, you know, live with a kind of partial deal. I mean, in other words, I think what they would like to do, but let me be clear about this. I think what the administration is hoping to do is essentially to get the Iranians to agree that they will basically stop the 20% enrichment and draw down their 20% enriched uranium stockpile, and have the, you know, enhanced day-to-day visits to the enrichment facilities, checking on the coverage by the video cameras. In return for a partial but not complete withdrawal of the sanctions. That's my guess. You know, I mean, that's just the logic of, that's based on a logical deduction from what we're getting from these senior officials.
You're saying that's best case scenario, that they would compromise at that?
That's what they want. The administration feels that they might be able to obtain. In other words, they would be happy if the Iranians continue to enrich at 5%, but they have all these limitations, you know, of really very good coverage, day-to-day coverage, and they know exactly what's going on, and they can assume that the Iranians can't get away with any hanky-panky. As long as they're not enriching to 20%, they're pretty relaxed about it. I think that's the situation that we're looking at. So I think that they're going to test whether they could get away with that kind of a deal.
Yeah, well, so what are the Americans going to use as their excuse to kill the deal then?
Well, I mean, they'll say, well, we're just not convinced that the Iranians have no intention of having a nuclear weapon. They haven't gone far enough. It will be that kind of very generalized complaint. It won't be on the basis of any specific technical issue. I mean, that would be my assumption.
Yeah. Well, and then also the Israelis. How bad? Netanyahu seems absolutely shameless in this. He doesn't care who knows if he's the one who pays Jandala to blow up what, right, at this point. He'll do anything to stop this, won't he?
Well, I mean, what can you say about the Israelis that is bad enough to really cover the subject? I don't know. I mean, the degree
of dishonesty... Well, you should have heard me earlier, man. I'm glad you didn't.
The degree of dishonesty that is has been displayed for so long by Israel on so many things is just... it's appalling. I mean, I can't think of any historical case that I know of where government has lied so often and you know, so consistently as the Israelis have. And Netanyahu absolutely is the worst of all.
Yeah, it reminds me of my dad telling me about during Vietnam when they would actually have reporters, it would be on a delay or whatever, but they would actually have reporters going, yep, here are the piles of the bodies of the Americans who died today, and most of the bad guys seem to have gotten away, and then cut straight to the briefing where, oh, we wiped them all out, and we only had very light casualties, and that it was like that day after day after day, and they never could coordinate the lie to make it make any sense whatsoever, and that's how this seems to me, like my friend Philip would say, it's the Three Stooges Plumber's School of Foreign Policy here. The reason that the water's not coming through is because this pipe's all full of wires.
Well, I think you're right to liken the to draw a parallel there between what the Israelis, how the Israelis operate in terms of their propaganda on Iran and associated issues, and the U.S. 5 o'clock follies, as they were called in Vietnam. I mean, both are equally deserving of you know, a lot of making fun and really just complete disrespect. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think maybe I don't know why this became the best way to phrase it, but it's the Fonzie jumping the shark thing, where your TV show is old hat now, and we don't like it anymore, and it's time to cancel it kind of thing. And I think that Netanyahu is getting to that point where I see very mainstreamy kind of websites see him as nothing but a butt of a joke, you know, at this point.
He's a fool, yeah. I mean, I think that's becoming much more prevalent, although certainly not unanimous, that there is a growing awareness on the part of sober-minded Israelis, Zionists, if you will, that Netanyahu has, in fact, made a joke of the entire issue, and that he doesn't have much credibility outside, you know, very, very limited media circles anymore. Even though, you know, one has to say that there's still the coverage of this issue until just right up until this agreement, still reflected far too much the Israeli point of view. Just simply reflecting, well, Mr. Secretary, what do you say to the Israeli complaint that, you know, is the standard question to be asked to any U.S. official, and that is still far too prevalent. Nevertheless, I mean, Netanyahu's extreme behavior, I mean, the fact that he's making statements that are simply so demonstrably false and, you know, can be so easily shown to be false, I think is not doing anything for his credibility, and that is that's a positive part of the situation for sure. I mean, that's one of the things that has continued to
There's a big difference between say anything and do anything. What are the limits you think on what he would do, or how far? I guess the better way to put it is, how far do you think he might really go?
Well, I mean, one of the things that has started to be reported more frequently is the fact that the Israeli military, the IDF, has no stomach for an attack on Iran. Mm-hmm. I saw a report. I'm not as good as you are in remembering from day to day where I read things, and so at this moment I can't remember where this is reported in the last 24 to 48 hours. But there was a report saying, you know, citing Israeli military sources as saying, you know, I'm not even sure we have the capability to do this. We're not even sure the Americans have the capability to do this, to attack Iranian sites successfully.
Oh, I hadn't seen that one.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a trend in the future, and because it is so clear, and I talk about this in my book at some length, that the Israeli military never believed that they had a realistic capability to do anything about the Iranian nuclear program, that it made the slightest bit of sense to threaten it made no sense to seriously contemplate it, even though it's true that most of the Israeli military and intelligence elite were willing to remain silent while Netanyahu made those threats, on the assumption that he wasn't serious about it and that it was really intended simply as a device to get the United States and the rest of the six powers essentially to take a much more a much harsher a posture toward Iran, particularly on the sanctions. But obviously, they would be happy if the United States would in fact be willing to have a military confrontation with Iran. I mean, that part of it, you know, the IDF people, for the most part, were more open to, but certainly not an Israeli attack on Iran. That's something that I think is simply has been a ruse from the beginning. It's just a lie.
Well, there is a good roundup of statements along those lines by the Israeli military today at the 972 Mag, if people want to check that out.
Oh, good.
I'm sorry, at the 972 Mag?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We got to go. We're all out of time. Thank you so much, Gareth, as always. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
IPSnews.net for Gareth Porter, y'all.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Rocky Mountain Miners at RockyMountainMiners.com. Ever wanted to destroy the Federal Reserve System? Now's your chance. New free market currencies are making our fake government money a thing of the past, and good riddance. If you want to mine new bitcoins and litecoins into circulation, you need a computer set up to crack the codes to the new coins. Get the Prospector from RockyMountainMiners.com. It's ready to do the work right out of the box. Crack the equations, spend the money. Use promo code Scott Horton Show and save $100. Get all the info and get the Prospector at RockyMountainMiners.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. I got a lot of things to cover, so I'm going to probably spend the rest of the next half hour on one thing like I always do. Nah, I try to mix it up for you here. All right. First of all, I have to stay on Iran and Israel and those kinds of topics for a moment here. I guess I'm going to have to page down a little bit. I'm only going to pick on Rand Paul a little bit here. My point isn't to pick on Rand Paul this time, but it involves him, and that is that he said some mealy-mouthed thing about containing Iran, and I like sanctions, but just not today. Well, he basically adopted Obama's position on the thing. And so here he is getting attacked, which Obama's position being light years or, I don't know, parsecs or some crap better than anything any Republican is saying. But he basically just gave a non-answer and angered everybody, trying to please everybody. But that, of course, was occasion for Jennifer Rubin to attack him again in her column in the Washington Post, and she's my real target here because, it's not even that. It's the things that she says, and I guess really, honestly, guys, I was actually really impressed by something in this article, which was that, wow, people really do read and write and believe this stuff. Really. I forget sometimes that Jennifer Rubin is real and not just a figment of my nightmares, you know, and that she could, I guess, believe anyway, I guess literally get away with, and I don't mean in any avoiding of censoring sake, but I just mean a criticism. She can get away with saying the most ridiculous things. And this ought to be a real clue to all of you, to anyone of any ideology or no ideology, any American ought to be able to tell that, man, whenever the warmonger types are trying to get something bombed, they're always dishonest about how bad it needs doing. They never actually have a real case. They just have to make up a bunch of crap instead. And that'll do. And, you know, crap is better for getting people to want to have a war. But on the other hand, I like to believe that there could be some backlash from that, too. And people might come to remember, oh, geez, it's sort of just like Waco every day around here, where we found some crazy people that you just can't deal with because they're so crazy. And they've got illegal weapons, which they're not allowed to have. And they're bad to their own people, of the following six examples. And so we got to go in and kill them. And how it always turns out. Cause suicide too. They brought it on themselves. They're so apocalyptic, these people. And then we always find out later that, hey, none of that was right, really, huh? You guys sort of lied about how important it was that you kill those people and do those things over and over again. And, you know, the Americans are learning, for real. And what's funny is the anti-war movement is gone. The people are, no war! Come on, guys, let's go outside in massive numbers and make a show of force and let the government know that we don't want this anymore. They don't care anymore. They're the ones most likely to worship the president still. And I guess that's not really true, but at least they're just not, maybe they're the first ones to be disappointed in Obama, but they're still not motivated to get out and fight about it. Meanwhile, the entire American population has turned against war, especially in the Middle East. Don't want another thing to do with another grain of sand. Leave me alone. I don't even know where that is. I don't care, and I don't want nothing to do with it, and that's why my ancestors escaped some hellhole so they could move to North America and not to worry about that crap. Leave me alone, and leave my kids alone. No, they won't go kill and die for you either. That's the attitude of the entire American population now. See, for example, the conflict in this country over whether or not to have a war in Syria 6 weeks ago. Eight. The American people, at least all of the ones who bothered to chime in, said no. I even, we talked about it on the show. There was actually at least one town meeting, which was actually covered by military.com. One town meeting where a right-wing hawk military veteran Republican congressman held a town hall in his very conservative Republican district, and the entire, and everybody came, and it was unanimous that people were against it. And in fact, they let people come up and say what they wanted to say pseudo-privately, kind of line up and talk to him for a minute and then move on kind of thing, instead of having to say what they want to say in front of everyone where maybe the peer pressure might sway them this or that way or something. And the congressman said everyone, all of them, without exception, said no, enough of this. Why? No, don't want to. Too expensive, too violent, too far away. Don't care. I think they'd be killing each other before and after we leave and during too. And so, so it's funny that there's that kind of consensus out here in the world, while the anti-war movement itself has gone virtually silent. And while, of course, the consensus in Washington, D.C. is that you just can't give up leadership, or as Gareth Porter would call it, dominance over the world. They just can't imagine. And even Rand Paul, the son of Ron, instead of saying, listen, here's the case for let's be friends with Iran, and Jennifer Rubin doesn't know what she's talking about. Instead of that, he goes, oh, well, let me concede all your points about what a danger Iran is, and what a great idea it is to put all these sanctions on their grandparents and dying children in the hospital. And yeah, you know, kids get leukemia, and sometimes they need some treatment for that or else, right? Jennifer Rubin, you're right about all your assertions about Iran and just how dangerous and just how important it is that we deal with them and how we cannot ever allow them to have nukes and we gotta... But, you know, in this case, I kind of think that maybe we shouldn't be, what, so loud about it? What is his argument at that point? He doesn't have an argument anymore. So now Jennifer Rubin comes after him, and here's what Jennifer Rubin says. Jennifer Rubin says, the Soviet Union, you know, oh, she's attacking him for saying containment. What does that even mean? Is he saying that now he is okay with them having nukes? Nobody knows what he means. She assumes that that's what he means. All right. Well, that worked with the Soviet Union, which was not an Islamist revolutionary state where suicide was glorified. Really, yeah, it was run by that cool, calm, and collected Joseph Stalin. Second or third place, depending on exactly if you want to go back to Tamerlane or Genghis Khan, I don't know. It certainly top five mass butchers of all time. Right up there with Mao and Hitler. Top three, really, with Mao and Hitler. And who, of course, the American policy portrayed as, you know, absolutely hell-bent on world domination at any cost, including a suicidal war. That's why we got to strike them first and this and that. All of Jennifer Rubin's neocon forebears were the most hawkish ones on rolling back the Soviet Union before it comes for us. But now, the Soviet Union, they were the epitome of rationality. And we always did like them, really. Well, the neocons are almost to a man a bunch of former Reds of one stripe or another, aren't they? Oh, come on. They like Trotsky, not Stalin, Scott. So that's different. Anyway. So she says that's the big difference, see? Like David Koresh, they're hell-bent on suicide. Unlike the perfectly rational and reasonable USSR back in the day. And also, oh, so therefore, they're undaunted by the threat of weapons of mass destruction to them. They'll do anything. They'll give up their whole civilization if they can just get one good swing at your jaw. Why not? They think. Jennifer Rubin wants you to think. Does that really seem right to you? That any politician who runs a government is willing to give up anything that he doesn't absolutely have to? Starting with his life and his power. Oh, I know. I'll get myself H-bombed deliberately. Okay. Yeah, that's what they're after. That's their first priority. And so therefore, also, she says next, they will be inclined to give nuclear material to the assortment of terrorists they support. Really. That is how Iran is going to initiate their own suicide by hydrogen bomb. They're going to make a nuke somehow magically, never mind the 95 impossible things that would have to happen for that to happen. And then once they get one, they're going to give it to Nasrallah? Really? That means he's the boss of Hezbollah. Really? They're going to give it to Nasrallah, huh? People read this in the Washington Post, and I guess some of them must think that so it's vetted by somebody smart or something who thinks this is plausible, right? Are you with me so far? These kooks are so nuts, they'll do anything to make a bomb to give it away to a tiny little sub-state pseudo-sock puppet ally of theirs in southern Lebanon. And then she says, and finally, Rand Paul and your contain Iran argument, your attempted halfway point between reason and neoconservatism, she says, and finally, that policy of Cold War containment entailed escalating defense budgets, overseas bases and missile deployments, support for authoritarian regimes that acted as a bulwark against communism, and aggressive support for freedom fighters, meaning non-state actor, armed right-wingers, all death squads. All things which Rand Paul now seems to oppose. Well, that's not really right. He said we should close down some of our overseas bases. Is all. Some meaning few. If it was really up to him. And yeah, he doesn't seem, you know, very interested in funding dictatorships. But then again, have you listened to what he has to say about his fear of Islam and the myth that he assents to, that somehow Islam itself, meaning I guess the billion plus people in the world who believe in it as a religion, is somehow a pseudo nation state in its own way, I guess mostly from Morocco to Indonesia, Philippines, but and or including maybe your neighborhood too. And that this Islamo-fascist caliphate of Rand Paul's imagination, it has initiated war against Western civilization, which we are in the middle of and in which we are the defenders. That is the kind of ridiculous crap this guy says in his speeches about radical Islam. You know, it's like New World Order. Does it mean a plan for something? Or it means a secret group of people? Do they call themselves that? I mean, what are we talking about exactly? Yeah, it's the Islam New World Order. Everything that happens in the world is that. I mean, everything you don't like. It's kind of like the devil. That's the devil. That's Islam. Everything that you think is not good, Islam. Radical Islam. They started it. Ask Rand. And now, you know, I'd like to say he's pretty good on Afghanistan. He says maybe we should get out of Afghanistan. I'm trying to give him credit for being what Jennifer Rubin accuses him of here. He has said that the Senate should vote on whether to continue the Afghan occupation in any way at this point. But in the past, he's written a joint letter saying that he endorses troops staying for counterterrorism missions and for training. Well, that means war. That means troops stay. That means not just JSOC, but SOCOM, the bigger, lesser JSOC, and force protection for them. That means Air Force bases, right? I mean, come on. What are we talking about? We're talking about staying. So, it's in Jennifer Rubin's ridiculous hawk interest to pretend that he's his father. It ain't true. I wish he would start pretending he was. That would be nice. I think that he would be able to whoop her in an argument if he didn't think that the best way to win an argument is to concede all of the things that your opponent gets wrong and in the worst way first. It's polite. I read one time, had a security guard job, reading books is what it really was one time. And I read How to Win Friends and Influence People. And they said, no, you should concede as much of your opponent's argument as you can. But as you can, not all the stuff that's wrong. Anyway. So, all of his sucking up to the neocons, going to meeting with Dan Senor and Bill Kristol, and being bad on Guantanamo, being bad on Palestine, being bad on Iran sanctions, being bad on investigations and prosecutions of American government officials who are guilty of the felony of torture and conspiracy to commit torture, and all those other things. It hasn't bought him any respect from the hawks at all, whether the right-wing nationalists or the neoconservatives. For the new people, neoconservatives means former commies and socialist Democrats, Trotskyites, who became right-wing Reaganites, and sometimes their sons. Like, I guess Bill Kristol was born already converted to the right half of it, right? His father was the commie, the former commie, and he was born to the former commie, but he's still a perfect neocon in that way. So there are exceptions to the biographical definition, and I'm not exactly sure whether Jennifer Rubin was ever a communist, but she sure writes like one, you know, as far as the dishonesty and everything. Anyway. And then here at the end, she threatens him, by the way. Here's how much love from the neoconservative movement Rand Paul's numerous, wide and varied sellouts have earned him from the neoconservatives. It is disturbing both that Paul's grasp of history and foreign policy instincts are so bad. It is even more alarming that neither he nor his staff seems to learn from errors. We already have a president impervious to reality and living in a cocoon. Why would we want another one? Moreover, Rand's position, again, Jennifer Rubin writes at the Washington Post, is entirely antithetical to the interests of Israel, which is, of course, not true. The guy lays on his belly and repeats whatever they want. But anyway, she's not impressed. Moreover, his position is entirely antithetical to the interests of Israel. That is his right. But then he's got no business calling himself pro-Israel. And he should expect ferocious opposition from Christian conservatives who understand his thinking is wrong-headed and dangerous. So there you go. She's, you know, trying to sic the Christian right on as best she can there. Although I think they probably see a lot in him in a lot of ways. But anyway, it's, again, Rand Paul doesn't make the argument that, hey, you know what? There are a lot of people who know what's better for Israel than Benjamin Netanyahu, all right? There are a lot of people who know what's better for Israel than Jennifer Rubin does, starting with me and everybody else here. What the hell are we talking about? These people's plan is to have Israel cease to exist within a generation, maybe much less. That's, of course, what Ehud Barak, the defense minister himself, says is correct, but then continues down that same path anyway. And that means they'll have to abandon democracy because the Jews will be the minority in greater Israel. And if they give every man one vote, they'll lose their power and they'll give up democracy before they give up being a Jewish state. And then it'll just be South African apartheid. And then outright, it's already in many ways, but you understand what I mean about the sort of change in the form legality-wise and how people perceive it. And at that point, you know, it'll just be a matter of I don't know how long before that just can't hold. They'll have to hold elections or they'll just have to flee to Europe or wherever. That's the Israeli right's plan. That's Benjamin Netanyahu's plan. To blow up his own country, because that's what he is. He's a suicide bomber. He's so hell-bent on hurting other people, he doesn't understand how badly he's driving his own society into a ditch. So, you could even be Rand Paul and know better than that. And you could be Rand Paul and easily explain it, too. Really? What are they going to do? How are they going to be a Jewish democracy when the Jews are a minority in their democracy? I thought it was the policy of George W. Bush that there should be a Palestinian state. Rand Paul can't even stick up for that. Oh, no, he ain't never heard of the Palestinians before. But what respect has that bought him from Jennifer Rubin? Where has it gotten him? I mean, I'd like to say except crossways with me, but that doesn't mean anything, I guess. It does bother me, though. I think there's a lesson there. Ron Paul had a lot more of an effect. And you know, I don't think Rand Paul stands a snowball's chance in hell of being president ever. He's so lucky he got to become a senator. He could be a badass senator right now, but instead he's got to be a kind of a one in order to try to get an even better job than that. And it ain't going to work. And then, once he's president, he'll have all that many more reasons to compromise that much further on every bit of this stuff anyway, as everyone recognizes. That's why Ron Paul, you know, he never really accomplished a whole lot legislatively. He didn't lead a bunch of, you know, severe committee investigations into, you know, cover-ups and this kind of thing. Because you have to give too many favors back to get other congressmen to help you do stuff like that. So he just gave speeches and voted no. And proved that he meant what he said and explained how liberty works as it ought to. And coincidentally, you know, it's the most moral thing anyway, but... And how because you people don't believe in liberty, you are embarking upon this policy which is mistaken and misbegotten and which will result in the following folly. As anyone with a cursory understanding of economics could predict. And there he goes, and he gives a speech, and he votes no, and he sets an example. And, you know, it's true that he never really got famous that way. He got famous only running for president, but if Rand Paul... Think of it like this. If Rand Paul really acted like his father's son in the Senate, how awesome would that be? Where he's way out ahead of Wyden and everybody on all the privacy issues. Way out ahead of every Democrat when it comes to peace. On Palestine, on Iran, on Syria, on all of it. Way out ahead of them. Taking firm stands, courageous ones, on important controversial issues. Like, why hasn't he been fighting to end the Afghan war this whole time? I mean, again, just showing up and voting no and giving speeches. But being serious about it, trying to be a leader about it. Think of how awesome it could have been already in place of how awesome it has not been. That's my problem. I got too good of an imagination. You know? I mean, if it had been me, I might have even compromised. Fine, I'll be a Ron Paul minarchist. I'll be a Ron Paul constitutionalist up there, but I'll be a Ron Paul one. And that means hardcore for liberty. Not, oh, guess how ambitious I am, guys? A lot. What can I do for you? How can I sell out my legacy for you? All right, anyway, see, I spent the whole half hour talking about one thing, didn't I? Damn it. I almost started with the cops shooting the lady story so that that wouldn't happen. But anyway, so the cops shot this lady. Somebody called the cops because they heard some noise. And keep this in mind, seriously. I know a lot of people are conditioned. Oh, I wish the neighbors would turn the noise down. And you pick up 911 like it's a remote control. Please go tell my neighbor to keep down the noise. Well, the cops came and they killed this lady. They shot her to death. And she was just some tiny little multiple sclerosis having 51-year-old lady. They say she had a knife. Well, I don't even know that that's true, do you? I say she's innocent of holding a knife, which isn't a crime in the first place. But anyway, if she had a knife, it's probably because the cops came and made a bunch of loud noise outside, and she went outside with a knife to see what the hell was going on, and brought the knife, you know, to help try to protect herself, as in her right to bear arms in order to protect her own life on her own property. They say, well, she was standing there with a knife, and that they yelled to drop the knife. But she kept standing there, probably wondering, what the hell is wrong with these guys? Why are they screaming and panicking and freaking out at me? I don't understand. And then they just killed her by shooting her a bunch of times to death. Somebody's mom, somebody's sister, somebody's wife. They shot her. For what? For standing there. They didn't even pretend. Oh, yeah, she came at me, boss. Which would have been a damn lie. But she was standing there in her driveway with a knife, and they killed her. And that's real. You can find the link on my Facebook page right now. Happens every day in this country. People sentenced to death by the lowliest sheriff's deputy or city policeman over nothing. Over nothing. And so stop pretending that this is some TV show where the cop is the most decent and reasonable one in the whole episode, because that is not the real world at all. And the terrible things you hear about cops doing from time to time to other people far away, that could be your fault. You imagine if you did that to someone? You call the cops over nothing? Guy and his wife arguing and they wake you up? And then so the cops come and kill them? Don't do it. You know, if it's the middle of a hardcore armed robbery or something, even then I would be reluctant. But just for tattletaling on people, think of it like this. If it's something that you don't want to see someone shot over, then let it slide. Right? Like in Soviet communism, was where the state was responsible for everything and nobody ever called them ever because they knew better.